Welcome, everybody. My name's Rebecca Derrant, and I'm National Head of Private Clients at Crowe UK LLP. I'm joined today by Lucy Edwards, who's a partner in the Private Clients team at Penningtons Manchester Cooper LLP. What we're going to talk about today are the tax implications of marriage and civil partnerships. None of this is going to be rocket science. We're going to cover some of the practical planning aspects for couples based on some real-life examples. We have changed the names to protect the innocent. The implications of residence and fundamentally the difference in tax treatment for cohabitees. Next slide. So, in terms of the tax implications of marriage and civil partnerships, the fundamental taxes that we'll be covering today will be around income tax, residence and domicile, capital gains tax, and inheritance tax. These are most often where we see issues arising for couples. But also fundamentally, these taxes tend to kick in around significant life events such as divorce and death. And both of these topics will be covered within our case studies today. In terms of an agenda, I'm going to hand over to Lucy shortly to cover the overview of the legislation. I will then talk you through case study number one, which is Ross and Rachel. I'll hand back to Lucy to do case study number two, Piper and Alex. And then at the end, we'll have a short summary covering off some key takeaways. Next slide. Lucy, over to you.
Thanks, Rebecca. So let's first look at how a spouse or civil partner is categorised for tax purposes. Now, the legislation doesn't directly define the term spouse or civil partner, so we take their meaning from the general law. This provides that the term spouse generally applies to parties of a legal marriage. And for that to be the case, the ceremony needs to comply with the requirements of the relevant part of the UK. Civil partnerships were introduced in the UK in 2004 by the Civil Partnership Act. The rights and responsibilities of civil partners, or CPs as I'll refer to them, are very similar to those of marriage, and there's a formal process for dissolving them, akin to a divorce. The tax consequences are identical to those of marriage. Initially, the 2004 Act only provided same-sex civil partnerships. That was extended to include opposite-sex couples in 2019. Also relevant is the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act 2013, which introduced same-sex marriages in England and Wales. And in addition to these, there are various acts and regulations to bring their provisions into force. Importantly, what a marriage does not include is when a couple is cohabiting, no matter how long that is, but they haven't actually married. That said, it is worth noting there's an historic form of Scots law marriage that was referred to as a marriage by cohabitation with habit and repute. And that was a form of irregular marriage that could be recognised as such legally, albeit that a ceremony hadn't been entered into. Now, that was actually abolished in 2006, but it still may be relevant for some purposes in courts in future if a couple is looking to rely on a period of cohabitation that they want to treat as marriage for tax purposes. Now, if that is the case, or uncommon as it may be, HMRC will refer it to their technical team for guidance. So, with these rules establishing the legal definition of marriage and civil partnership, is this status treated in the same way for tax purposes? Well, generally speaking, the answer is yes, and there's a similar treatment, but the tax rules can apply differently over certain periods. For income tax and capital gains tax purposes, what's relevant to bear in mind is that the legislation refers largely to spouses and civil partners who are living together as such. That distinction is not made in the inheritance tax rules. The dates for those that are relevant are either the decree absolu for a marriage or the final dissolution order for a civil partnership. And we'll be looking at how these provisions and the more complex rules that apply within them work in the case studies.
Thanks, Lucy. Could I just ask a question around foreign unions? Does the UK recognise those in the same way?
Yes, it does in many cases. There are various provisions for recognising foreign unions under UK law. Generally speaking, when a marriage or civil partnership ceremony has been conducted abroad, it needs to have met the requirements of a valid marriage according to the law of the country in which it's conducted. that is what enables spouses to be recognised as such for UK tax purposes. So, for example, if the law of the country that's relevant allows polygamous marriage, then that will be recognised for tax purposes. For example, the spouse exemption for IHT when you're looking to claim a transferable nil-rate band, of course, subject to the limitations within the rules for doing that.
Thank you. So, next slide, case study one, Rachel and Ross. You will get the reference, I think, very shortly. So Ross and Rachel have been married for over 20 years, most of which happily, although they have been on a break. They have two teenage children, Phoebe and Joey, who are 17 and 19, respectively. Ross and Rachel are 52 and 47 years old, respectively. They're both UK resident and domicile, so we're not going to have to consider any overseas issues in this particular case. Ross is in business with his younger siblings, Monica and Chandler, and they run a successful clothing retail business worth around £50 million. The shares are held equally between the three siblings. Rachel also works in the business as a fashion buyer, earning around £30,000 per annum, including benefits. And she does like to take an interest in the running of the business more generally. They own property, being the family home, which is jointly held, and two buy-to-let properties, which Ross holds in his own name. They also have a holiday home in Cornwall, which they, again, is jointly held. Ross has been very protective of his income and assets over the years, and he has other cash, again in his own name, in the region of £250,000 and an investment portfolio currently valued at £200,000. Next slide. This slide illustrates the asset summary for Ross and Rachel. So as you can see, we've got the business asset of around £5 million for Ross, the family home, the buy-to-let properties, which are mortgaged, of a £100,000 mortgage against those properties. There is a mortgage against the family home of £200,000, which is split equally, the Cornish property, the cash and the share portfolio. So the balance of assets, with Ross having just shy of 6.5 million and Rachel of 600,000, are very unevenly split. Again, as we say, Ross has been very protective of his income and assets over the years, due to some of the fluctuations in their happiness within the marriage, I guess. Ross also draws dividend income of around £200,000 per annum from the business and a salary of 50. And the buy-to-let properties are generating rental profits of £200 per month. Next slide. So Ross and Rachel have been discussing their financial situation for a number of years and not really been able to reach an agreement. They've been married for 23 years, relatively happily, although they have had some issues. They've come to talk to you today because they want to try and resolve their financial position. The biggest issues that they've got at the moment are that they don't have wills. There has been a new shareholders agreement for the business prepared, which dictates that on the death of a shareholder, the shares must be sold back to the business at market value. Rachel is not altogether happy about this. She does take a keen interest in the business and is not really comfortable that should anything happen to Ross, she would lose essentially what she sees as a stake in the business. And she wants to understand what the consequences for her around this are, particularly from a tax perspective. There's also a potential sale planned of the business over the next 3 to 5 years. The director shareholders are currently looking at how they can accelerate value in order to be able to achieve what they want from that sale within the coming years. So Ross and Rachel have come to see you for some family wealth planning advice as to how they can maybe resolve some of these issues and structure their affairs more efficiently. Next slide. So initial thoughts. We're going to cover off most of the direct taxes within this review, but certainly if we think about basics, if we look at the income tax position, Ross and Rachel's income is very imbalanced. We could really be making much better use of personal allowances and lower rate bands to save them some tax on an annual basis. We could also be thinking about income for the children. The children are essentially young adults, that don't really get any cheaper as they get older. They could be in university, they could be looking at buying cars, potentially houses in the future. And at the moment, those expenses will be being met out of taxed income by the parents. potentially we might want to think of a way of being able to pass some of the income producing assets to the children in order for them to use their lower rates and personal allowances. We do need to bear in mind settlements legislation. Phoebe is still only 17, so any income that she would receive derived from capital provided by the parents would still be taxed on the parents at this stage, but that position is not going to last forever. So maybe we should start to think about some planning for that situation now. Similarly, if we start to think about trusts, as we've said, Ross is very protective of his assets. He may feel more comfortable about using a trust to generate income that the children could then use. Again, we need to think about settlements legislation, but once Phoebe's over 18, income could be distributed from those trusts with the attached tax charge, which could then be reclaimed by the children if they weren't using their personal allowances and lower rates. Next slide. So just in summary, to illustrate the position on the income tax, this is the current position. So Ross has income of just of around £285,000 on an annual basis, whereas Rachel's is only 30. That's resulted in a tax liability of £97,000 for Ross against £3,500 for Rachel. So there's a massive difference there, and Rachel clearly isn't using her tax rates efficiently. Next slide. If we were simply to think about transferring some assets from Ross to Rachel, we could divert some of the income into Rachel's hands and generate a tax saving. In the example I've given here, we transferred 5% of the company shares to Rachel. We've transferred half the buy-to-let properties and half of Ross's equity portfolio. Very small changes, but actually, when we compare the tax liability on this slide to that on the previous slide, we're saving around £7,000 per annum. Now, that doesn't appear to be a huge amount comparatively when we're talking about the wealth that the couple have. But if Ross could be a little bit more generous or willing to let more income and assets go, we could actually save much more. And the conversation that we should be having with the couple at this stage is, how much do you want to generate a tax saving from? And sometimes when the couple sees the numbers, in this case, it actually encourages them to make more changes. Next slide. So if we're transferring assets in order to rebalance the income, what are the capital gains tax implications? Transfer of assets usually have a capital gains tax position to consider. Transfer of assets between husband and wife are tax-free, essentially. They're transferred on a no gain, no loss basis, which means that when Ross transfers an asset to Rachel, she acquires that asset at Ross's base cost, so whatever he paid for it or acquired it for. So ultimately, the capital gains tax would crystallise when Rachel sold the asset in terms of growth of value across the whole ownership period. What we often look at when we're talking about transferring property, for example, is completion of a deed of beneficial interest rather than a full conveyance of the property. What this means is that, as in this case, if Ross transfers half of his property interest to Rachel, he would essentially complete a deed of beneficial interest to ratify that. And that would mean that he held the legal title doesn't change, but that he would hold the beneficial interest of Rachel's share on trust for her as nominee. So she would be taxed on any income or gains, but the legal title of the property wouldn't change. Similarly, but on a flip side, HMRC recognised what we call a Form 14. So this form applies where property or assets are held jointly. The standard position for HMRC in that respect is to tax that asset 50-50. So 50% of any income or gains would be taxed on each of the couple. If in actual fact the beneficial interest is at different proportions, the couple can complete this form, submit it to HMRC before the beginning of the tax year, and then they will recognise that potentially there may be a 70-30 split on the income and gains arising from that asset. So that is something that HMRC do recognise rather than as a legal transfer. One of the other points to mention with this, particularly around the shares in the business, you'll note from the original slide that we transferred 5% to Rachel, and there's a very good reason for that. Those of you that are familiar with business asset disposal relief, means that that gift to Rachel, if she has 5% of the shares, could mean that she can achieve a lower tax rate on the sale of the ultimate sale of the business. So business asset disposal relief is available on the disposal of shares in an individual's personal company. And what that means is that the vendor can achieve a 10% tax rate up to any gains of £1 million, up to £1 million. So in the situation that we've got at the moment, if Ross was to retain all the shares and sell them, he would only get 10% rate on £1 million of the proceeds. If we transfer 5% to Rachel, then ultimately she could achieve a 10% tax rate on up to £1 million of proceeds in her name, therefore saving tax at 10% on that proportion, which is in this example would be around £100,000. So it's not something that shouldn't be considered. So the qualifying conditions for business asset disposal relief are that the individual has to be a director or paid employee, which Rachel is. The individual needs to own 5% of the shares and voting rights in the company, be entitled to 5% of the income and capital on sale or winding up, and have held those shares for 24 months. So the thing that we need to be mindful of here is that if Ross does transfer shares to Rachel, then there's a 24-month period before Rachel will qualify for business asset disposal relief. Ultimately, we can also think about gifts to the children. If you think about the proceeds of £5 million, the more business asset disposal relief we can get on that sale, the better. However, transferring assets to children of the age that Phoebe and Joey are may not be the best option, even considering the tax savings. It's quite a large asset to be putting into the hands of teenage children. Ultimately, as well, a transfer to children is not under the same terms as that between husband and wife. It isn't tax-free. Although, because we are talking about a business asset, it is possible to claim holdover relief on that transfer, meaning again that the children would take on the base cost that Ross achieved. And finally, we could also think about a settlement into trust. This might not necessarily achieve the business asset disposal relief, but what it does mean is that we can get quite a valuable asset into trust, protected for children, for the children going forward, and generating some income for them.
Rebecca, could I
Yeah.
ask, returning to the transfer of property interests, what's the impact of the mortgage on the property? Does that affect the ability to gift?
It doesn't affect the ability to gift. We are still able to make the transfer. There are a couple of complications with that. The first one really is generally with the lender as to whether or not the lender would transfer the rights to the mortgage. Generally, that does happen. But the biggest question really around that would be stamp duty land tax. Again, transfers where there are no consideration don't have a charge to stamp duty land tax. But if the transferee takes on the liability of that mortgage, then potentially that's treated as consideration and we could have a charge to stamp duty land tax. So that could be a complication there. Thanks, Lucy. One of the final points I wanted to mention on this really is we've talked about transfers of assets between husband and wife being tax-free, but what if Ross and Rachel were not married? What if they were cohabitees? Where do we stand on the transfer in this position? Now, we're looking to transfer three different kinds of assets here, and the transfer of the business asset would actually be okay. We talked about holdover relief on transfers to gift of children, and that situation would be the same between cohabitees. So we should be able to transfer the business shares pretty easily. But in terms of the transfer of the property and the investment portfolio, that would crystallize a capital gain at market value. So it's not as easy to rebalance these assets between cohabitees as it is between married couples. So moving on to inheritance tax, there are a number of issues that Ross and Rachel need to consider here. Whether we qualify for business relief on the shares in the business, what the position is on the lifetime gifts between each other and to the children potentially. Will planning. This is really important. At the moment, they don't have a will, and that will have a huge impact on both asset protection and the tax position, which we will cover off very shortly. Use of trusts. This could be particularly important for Ross. He's obviously been very protective of his assets, not inclined to share particularly well so far. But ultimately, should something happen to him, does he want to leave the full value of his estate directly to Rachel? There are tax benefits of doing that. Transfers for inheritance tax between husband and wife are tax free. So inheritance tax generally only kicks in on second death. But ultimately, if Rachel inherits the bulk of Ross's estate, she's then entitled to do with that what she pleases. And should she marry again, that's going to have an impact on the children. So what we tend to consider here are trusts, in particular, an immediate post-death interest trust, commonly known as an IPDI. Basically, this means that the will can instruct that the estate is left into trust for Rachel for her lifetime, so she can benefit from the income during that period. But the assets are protected so that on Rachel's death, they pass to the children. We also tend to look typically at discretionary trust as part of will planning as well, and for lifetime planning, actually. Discretionary trust usually house assets that up to the nil rate band or assets that qualify for relief from inheritance tax, such as the business shares. And finally, one of the crucial questions for Ross and Rachel is, what is the impact of the shareholders agreement? Ultimately, the shares are in the estate at the moment and the beneficiaries would receive those, but those shares would be sold immediately back to the business, resulting in a large cash balance arising to the beneficiaries. So we need to think about what that means for them.
Looking at the availability of business property relief on the value of the business interests, is that position affected if they have arranged to sell the business at the time of the death or transfer? If it's subject to a contract for sale, does that scupper things?
It can do. And ultimately, I think usually now the shareholders agreements are drafted sufficiently well to make sure that there's no binding contract for sale on that impact of that sale back to the business. But that is something that does need to be checked. It can be quite difficult. But equally, if, for example, the sale was going through, you know, the third party sale was going through, and that it was kind of sufficiently down the line to constitute a binding contract for sale at that stage, and something happened to one of the parties in the middle, then yes, what that could mean is that actually we haven't got an asset that qualifies for business relief anymore. We've got a cash asset, which we'll see from the next slide, the next couple of slides, result in a much higher inheritance tax position on death than would have otherwise. The other point I wanted to mention briefly around the impact of the shareholders agreement isn't really a tax point, but it's kind of those discussions between parties about what happens at that stage, because there are other considerations in terms of emotional considerations, commercial impact. You know, Rachel, the family, it's a family business. They've had a lot of input into that business over the years, and that enforced sale, for example, could have an impact for them. Rachel may see herself as, you know, sat around the boardroom table making some of those decisions should something happen to Ross. And the impact of the shareholders agreement as it stands mean that that might not be the case. So as with anything with family, and particularly family business planning, a lot of it's around conversations and clarity rather than simple tax advice. So next slide, if we consider the numbers around the inheritance tax position for Ross and Rachel. This slide illustrates the asset summary as it stands at the moment prior to any transfers. So as we can see, Ross's net estate is just short of 6.5 million. Rachel has 600,000. So the total estate is just over £7 million. At this point, as we're talking here, we get business relief of 5 million to offset against that, plus individual nil rate bands of 325 each. So providing everything goes to plan, you know, should something happen to first spouse, that nil rate band will be transferable to second death, resulting in an overall inheritance tax liability of £560,000, which is not insignificant. But in terms of the value of the estate that we have at the moment is not particularly onerous, although there are certain things we would do to try and mitigate that.
Have we factored in the impact of the residence nil rate band?
We haven't in this case. The residence nil rate band is, as you are probably aware, £175,000 each. So ultimately, where the individuals qualify gives each spouse £500,000 tax-free each. However, in order to qualify for it, the estate has to be less than £2 million overall, and that includes any relief. So you would always include the value of the business within that assessment, which for a lot of people does then remove the availability of the nil rate band. The family home also has to be left to a child or lineal descendant. So there are certain conditions that need to be met, and it should always be considered. But in this particular instance, the estate's too valuable for them to be able to qualify. So you're having the conversation around the inheritance tax position. What kind of things would we talk about? What would we talk about to Ross and Rachel to help them minimize that liability? So just in terms of kind of simple, straightforward planning, they have the opportunity to maximize transfers into trust. So each individual can settle £325,000 into trust to create a settlement for the benefit of their children. As we've talked about earlier, in terms of distributions, we would need to wait until Phoebe was over 18 before she could receive any income from that. But ultimately, this could mean that we could achieve a saving of £240,000 of inheritance tax by making this settlement into trust. Once the settlement has been made, it will fall out of the estate after 7 years. And at that point, then the nil rate bands regenerate essentially. So Ross and Rachel are relatively young yet. So we could be looking at making settlements into trust over the next few years to maximise that saving. In terms of the assets that we've talked about transferring, we've looked at transferring buy-to-lets and equities to Rachel from Ross, but actually the value of those assets could be settled into trust for the children. We're saving the inheritance tax. The trust would pay tax on the income at the same rate that Ross currently pays, but it could then be distributed to the children and reclaimed subject to personal allowances and lower rate bands. So it is a relatively efficient way of moving capital out of the estate, but also making sure the children have access to some income to fund their ever-growing lifestyles as they get older. The second thing that we would always discuss with a couple in this situation is what happens once the business is sold. We've just looked on the previous slide at the level of inheritance tax that's payable at the moment, but once that business is sold and we've got cash rather than shares, that's going to increase the inheritance tax liability by £2 million. And that's really where we start to think we need to do some planning now to try and mitigate that. And one of the things that we often talk to clients about in this situation are family investment company structures. Now, we could do an entire session on a family investment company, but we won't be doing that today. But just in terms of of a brief overview, a family investment company is what it says on the tin. It's a company that invests rather than trades. Usually, the cash provided into the investment company is done by way of a loan by the founders. So in this case, our founders have resulted in cash from the sale of the business. They may decide to lend that cash, that consideration of 5 million, into the family investment company for the company to invest in equities, property, whatever they decide they want to do. At this point, then there's a saving on the income tax on the investment because we'll be taxing that at corporate rates rather than income tax rates. And as we can see at the moment, Ross is paying 45% tax on some of his income. We can also involve the children again at this point as shareholders in the family investment company to be able to move some of that income to them again to use their personal allowances and lower rates. Most importantly and crucially, from an inheritance tax point of view, the loan that's been made to the company is still within Ross and Rachel's estate at this point because none of it has been transferred. However, it is possible to transfer some of that loan to the children. And after 7 years, that would then fall out of the family estate. Any growth on the investment that's put in there already is moved away in proportion to the shareholders that apply to the children because that growth belongs to them rather than to Ross and Rachel. So you can see from an inheritance tax point of view, it's quite a flexible structure. And more importantly, probably for Ross, is that the money that's gone in has gone in by way of a loan. So should he want to be, take some of that back at some point, he's able to. He's able to take those loan repayments out tax-free. And for a lot of the clients that we talk to in this situation, that is one of the most important things. Because if we compare that to a settlement into trust, for example, once the cash has gone into a trust, it's in there and it can't be taken back. And so that flexibility is really important. And that actually then touches onto the next question. Could the business shares be settled into trust before sale? And yes, they could. And this is beneficial. It increases the value of the trust because you can put more in over and above your $650,000 without incurring a tax charge on settlement. But it does mean that the shareholders no longer have access to that cash once the business is sold. And that will be important, I think, for this couple here.
Are these planning opportunities available for an unmarried cohabiting couple?
Yes, they are. We would have in this particular case, if Ross and Rachel weren't married, we would have some issues initially around transferring sufficient assets to Rachel in order for her to make a settlement without incurring a tax charge. But generally, if you've got an unmarried couple who have access to assets, they can both settle into a trust in the same way. So the trust would be the trust could be stacked up in exactly the same way as we have with a married couple. Family investment company structure, most certainly. Again, you could have shareholders of family members of who you like. Once the inheritance tax saving comes from transferring a debt, which is free from tax anyway, so that can be transferred to a cohabitee, a child, tax-free. It is just a potentially exempt transfer for inheritance tax purposes. So, in terms of a cohabiting couple, this particularly the family investment structure kind of type planning would be really useful. Thanks, Lucy. Next slide. So fundamentally, at the moment, Ross and Rachel don't have a will. And this is pretty crucial, in terms of how they want their assets to be left. We talked about trust structures for asset protection and IHT benefits, protecting those assets for the children moving forward against any future remarriage or any change in circumstances. The key element with the will planning and the IHT planning in this particular case is around the spouse exemption. What we're doing as part of the will planning and the inheritance tax planning is relying upon assets being transferred to spouse on first death so that the inheritance tax charge doesn't kick in until second death. This situation doesn't apply to cohabitees. The difficulty with inheritance tax for cohabitees is that any gifts are potentially exempt transfers during a lifetime, which means they do fall out of an estate after 7 years, but not straight away. And if we think back to the asset summary that we looked at for Ross and Rachel, the assets that we would be transferring across on death would be charged to inheritance tax. If something happened to Ross first, we would ultimately have, based on his net estate of 6.5 million, an inheritance tax liability of 40% before it is then passed to Rachel. That net estate would then hit Rachel's estate, and then when something happened to her, we would have inheritance tax again. So cohabitees are in a very difficult position in that essentially there could be a double hit of inheritance tax charge on the death estate. Next slide. So we've had a lovely meeting. We've given them some really good tips on tax planning. We've given them a structure for what they might want to do with their will. But sadly, before any of this can be finalised, poor Ross is involved in a fatal car accident, coming back from the bank while he's stashing some more money away from Rachel. Even more tragically, the new wills have not been signed. Therefore, he dies intestate. So what happens next? Well, next slide. These are the intestacy rules, and these are taken directly from HMRC's website. So husband, wife or civil partner keeps all the assets, including property, up to £270,000 and all the personal possessions of whatever value. The remainder of the estate is then shared as follows. The husband, wife or civil partner gets an absolute interest in half of the remainder, so 50% of the balance of that estate. The other half is then divided equally between the surviving children. So in this case, Phoebe and Joey would receive 50% of Dad's estate at this point in time. Point to remember here around jointly held property, where we have joint tenants, then the tenancy does pass to the surviving tenant. So that would go first before we would start to consider the intestacy rules up to 270,000. So if we look at the next slide here, in terms of Ross's assets, the family home and the Cornish property would go to Rachel as of right. And then we would look at the rest of it as to how that would then be divided. And as you can see, we've got some very valuable assets here that are going to effectively be split 50% to Rachel and then 50% to two very young children.
Thanks, Rebecca. Would you mind recapping how there is a difference between beneficial ownership as joint tenants and as tenants in common?
Yeah. So in simple terms, a joint tenancy means that the two parties own the property, the whole of the property jointly. So if something happens to one, then the other automatically inherits. The tenancy can't be left in different ways to different people. We've got something that's completely owned jointly. Tenants in common is different. What that means is that the joint tenancy is severed and each party owns a specific part of each property. So in that, we tend to see that where when we were talking about wills and trusts before, the tenancy can be severed. So on first death, Ross could leave his half into trust for the children. You know, the surviving party tends to be able to live in the family home, say, until death or remarriage. And then the balance then goes to the children. And to do that, you have to sever that joint tenancy and make it tenants in common. What that does mean then, if you did do that, or we had done that, that on death in intestacy, Rachel wouldn't inherit that second share by right. It would fall part into the overall value of the estate to come under the intestacy rules. So in this case, the joint tenancy for her is really important and quite beneficial, whereas had it been the other way around, we wouldn't be necessarily as favourable a position here. So if we consider the intestacy rules and in the light of the conversations that we've just had around the asset values, Rachel will receive jointly held property. So she will take the family home and the Cornish property, and she will then receive 270,000 of the remaining assets. So that might be the cash and equity and some of the other elements. She then receives 50% of the balance of the estate, and Phoebe and Joey receive 25% each. At this point, on death, the shares in the business will need to be sold back to the company. So what we're talking about here is quite a substantial amount of cash available to the beneficiaries. So what are the problems? Well, here we've got IHT on assets transferred to the children above the nil rate band, where there is no business relief. So potentially, you know, however the assets are split, we could have the shares being transferred to the children with business relief. But had the business been sold prior to this, we would be talking about cash, which would mean there would be a significant charge, inheritance charge on the estate already, because the assets haven't been able to be passed to Rachel. More importantly, actually, we've got children here who are young adults of 17 and 20, and they're very young to be in control of such wealth. We have an estate, I think, if we recall correctly, that's just around just over £6 million. So essentially, the children have got around £3 million that they've got absolute access to. Phoebe wouldn't receive that access until she was 18, but she's 17 at the moment, so it's not a long amount of time before that would be possible. Rachel doesn't have access to the whole of the estate. This may or may not have been what Ross would have decided, but she is only 47 and she's got a lot of life to live yet. So ultimately, yes, she's getting a decent settlement, but is that what she'd anticipated? Is that kind of the lifestyle she'd expected to have for the next 40 years, while the children have now got access to what she might determine to be her money? And equally, from Ross's perspective, Rachel's share of the estate is not now protected for the children should she decide to remarry. Again, she's still relatively young. She may get married again, in which case, if she doesn't sort out any of the legal stuff around this, then that those assets, Ross's assets, could actually pass to somebody else and somebody else's family if it isn't protected well enough. So what can we do? Deed of variation, deed of variation, deed of variation, basically. So, deed of variation is more often seen as part of will planning, but they can also be done where somebody dies intestate. What we've seen in practical terms with this is that we can create trust for the children to protect their assets, and we can do some planning for Rachel in a similar vein so that she's protecting the assets for the children. But deed of variations have to be signed by the beneficiaries, so the beneficiaries have to agree to do this, and also Phoebe has to be of age to be able to sign this deed of variation. So whilst that is the advice we would give, it's not necessarily set in stone. We'd also look at investment and planning advice more generally. We've got a family now that have received a huge amount of cash from a business, and have got a long time now to live without dad. So we would need to look at planning, income generation, and what the future holds for them. So, question then, what if they weren't married? What would that mean? Well, ultimately, if we think about the asset summary that we had before, there would be a large inheritance tax liability on Ross's estate. But equally, Rachel, as an unmarried parent, wouldn't receive any of that. That estate would pass to the children directly. So we'd have some very wealthy kids and a very unhappy spouse in that particular situation. So in terms of advice, I think the will certainly is the biggest piece of advice to take away from this session. So now we've covered death, I'm going to hand over to Lucy to cover off divorce.
Great, thanks, Rebecca. So moving on to case study two, Piper and Alex. Next slide. So Piper and Alex are our couple who are going to enter into a civil partnership. They're both in their late 20s, living and working in London. They met at university in Bristol, stayed in touch, and became a couple 3 years ago. Piper grew up in Kent, moved to London with her parents when she was 12. Alex grew up in Canada, but stayed in the UK to work after university. Piper is completing a postdoctoral in anthropology. Alex has a well-paid job in marketing. They have separate flats, but have been living together at Piper's flat for the past 18 months. Piper inherited her flat from her grandmother 6 years ago. It's mortgage-free, but it's old and expensive to maintain. Alex bought her flat 5 years ago with an 80% mortgage. She intends to sell it when the market improves and will rent it out in the meantime. With more income than Piper, who's partially relying on her savings while she completes her research, Alex does pay the majority of the living and property costs. They're engaged to be civil partners and looking forward to their ceremony in 3 months' time. They want to share ownership of their home together and the income from Alex's flat. Alex has also built up an investment portfolio that they'd like to put into joint names as well. They plan to stay in London for the time being and in a few years move to Canada to settle. Both their families are supportive of their relationship and give them some, or intend to give them some money in the near future in order to help with their savings for the move. Next slide. So, Alex and Piper come to us for advice. First of their issues that they want to look at is the transfers of assets between them, moving assets into joint ownership. And the key question here is, should we do it now or should we do it after we become civil partners? So, effectively, when we're looking at moving assets into joint ownership, we're looking at a series of gifts between Alex and Piper. As Rebecca mentioned earlier, when we're looking at transferring assets into joint names, there is a general presumption that something moving into joint names is owned 50-50. So effectively, Piper's flat, she's giving a share to Alex, vice versa with Alex's flat, and then Alex's investment portfolio. Key taxes here that we'll be looking at are CGT, IHT and SDLT. I mentioned SDLT for completeness, but the tax position between a married or civilly partnered couple versus non-married couple is quite similar. A lot of the issues we'll touch on will be similar to what we've picked up in the first case study, but it's useful to see them in a different setting. So, some key principles to bear in mind before we delve into looking at the rules for each asset. Firstly, for CGT, as Rebecca mentioned, married couples or couples in a civil partnership are able to pass property between each other on a no gain, no loss basis. This means they receive the asset at the gifting partner's base cost. Now, there's no equivalent for unmarried cohabiting couples. Any gifts between them may be potentially taxable events for capital gains tax. And when we're looking at gifts of properties that have been lifted as homes, we've got principal private residence relief possible for CGT. Points to remember for inheritance tax are, as mentioned earlier, transfers between spouses on life or on death are generally completely exempt from IHT. There is a limitation on that exemption where there's a mix of domicile between spouses, which we'll come on to later. Again, for cohabiting couples, no such exemption. Any assets moving between them may be subject to inheritance tax. Now, the key issue here is we're making lifetime gifts, so they may be potentially exempt transfers. Next slide. So, scenario one, what would be the case if they do everything now, get the transfers done, so it's all behind them before they have their civil partnership ceremony? Well, let's take each in turn. Piper's flat. Again, running through the capital gains tax treatment, these are a cohabiting couple. They aren't married. They haven't got the special tax reliefs available for married couples. So gifts between them are treated as effectively disposals at market value for capital gains tax purposes. However, Piper, if she's giving part of her interest in her home, assuming that PPR for CGT is applicable, that will be available there to stop there being an immediate tax charge if she is joining in Alex into the ownership. An important point to mention here is that for the purpose of this example, we are treating these gifts as independent of each other, not dependent, not connected. So we're looking at each in turn. For inheritance tax, a gift of half of Piper's flat to Alex is going to be a potentially exempt transfer. So it's going to be relevant as a gift part of her estate for the next 7 years if something were to happen to Piper and she died within that 7 years. The value of that gift for tax purposes is not just half the value of the house. It's the value by which Piper's estate has been reduced as a result of making that gift. So it might actually be a little bit more than Piper envisages when she puts Alex as a joint owner. Are there any anti-avoidance points to consider here? Because Piper will be continuing to live in the property she's giving away part of an interest in. Well, in order to be an effective gift for inheritance tax purposes, a donor needs to give away an asset without any strings attached. If they retain a benefit in or receive an income from an asset given away, it may be treated as part of their estate for inheritance tax purposes still. Thankfully, in this case, we've got an exception to the rules that applies, as Piper is going to be living and occupying that property with Alex. They will have to carefully consider how the finances are split, how the current arrangement they have for costs being met is going to be balanced in the round to make sure that there's no unconnected or ancillary benefit that Piper derives as a result of putting Alex in the picture on this. SDLT, not to worry about, as there's no consideration being given. Alex's flat, similar situation in terms of the capital gains tax. Inheritance tax, again, similar situation. We've got a pet for inheritance tax purposes. In this case, we can avoid there being a gift with reservation if Alex isn't living in the property and it's rented out, so she's no longer occupying it. Where this is different is we've got SDLT to consider. Now, this is going to be relevant whether Alex and Piper are civilly partnered or not. how SDLT works is that if you are deemed to be taking on a liability, such as a mortgage, in connection with receiving a gift, you're effectively purchasing that asset for the value of the liability you're taking on for SDLT purposes. Now, a practical point here that Rebecca mentioned earlier is that we've got the mortgage company to consider. They will need to be notified, likely give consent to the transfer, and they may well require that Piper comes on the mortgage in order to receive the beneficial interest. So the SDLT rate depends on the value given and the type of the property. And in this case, residential property, the limit before SDLT becomes payable is £125,000 at the moment. So it would require a SDLT return. Last but not least, Alex's investment portfolio, sitting at a moderate gain on the overall value of the portfolio from when Alex first invested. So bravo, investment managers. Similar implications for capital gains tax. It's a gift. Now, we don't have an exception that's going to apply here, such as the PPR. However, because Alex's investment portfolio is probably easier to gift in segments, if they had more time, they might look at making gifts over different tax years to utilise Alex's annual exempt amount for capital gains tax. Again, as with property, it's going to be a pet, anything that she gives for inheritance tax purposes.
Lucy, if a gift is made between two people who are not married and then they later become married, how would HMRC treat the gift if the donor were to die within 7 years?
That's a good question. Effectively, how a pet is defined for tax purposes is a transfer of value that... Sorry, I'm going to start that answer again. I found my notes. It's a good question because effectively the rules that govern how a pet is taxed for inheritance tax purposes are set out quite clearly, and they don't leave much room for arguing that a marriage gives retrospective tax treatment. What the Inheritance Act says is that a pet is exempt if it's made over 7 years before the transfer of value, in this case, if someone were to die. Any other type of pet is a chargeable transfer. So there's no room for subsequently going back and applying the spouse exemption. The relevant date that we are looking at when we're determining the tax treatment is the date of the transfer itself, and does the spouse exemption apply at that point? So unfortunately, any pets don't get converted after the civil partnership takes place.
Thank you.
So how is the situation different if the gifts happen after the ceremony? Well, it looks a little bit simpler, largely because we get to use the various favourable tax rules that Rebecca's already taken us through. Transfers between spouses for capital gains tax purposes take place at no gain, no loss. Inheritance tax transfers between spouses carry an unlimited spouse exemption, and the SDLT treatment is going to be the same. Now, a point to bear in mind that will change after their civil partnership is PPR for capital gains tax. At the moment, prior to civil partnership taking place, Piper is able to utilise PPR for her property, and Alex is able to have a separate PPR to Piper. Once they're civil partnered, they will have to share a PPR between them, so they will have to decide which property that is. And depending on the timing of a sale of a property or a transfer between them, we need to look carefully at how the ownership period interacts with the relevant period for occupying the PPR.
Lucy, on balance, what should they do?
Well, it looks a lot simpler post-civil partnership. Effectively, for inheritance tax, we're avoiding creating any potentially exempt transfers, which, if something were to happen to Piper or Alex in the next 7 years, would eat into or use up entirely their nil rate bands and themselves become a potentially, well, and themselves become a taxable gift. And for CGT, we're avoiding triggering a taxable gain on that investment portfolio or having to rely on PPR for the properties. Next slide. So here we have that summary at the top.
So does Alex's domicile change anything with that decision?
It does, or it can, is the answer. There are particular rules that govern the interaction of domicile and inheritance tax. So we've covered that there's an unlimited spouse exemption between spouses and civil partners. That isn't the case if there is a mix of domicile. If there's a mix, you're looking at a limited spouse exemption. So, domicile, what is it? It's a complex legal concept. An individual, generally speaking, will have a domicile of origin that's the domicile of their father at the time they were born. They can acquire a different domicile, a domicile of choice, somewhere else, if they move to another country or jurisdiction and decide to remain there permanently or indefinitely. So, to take our case study, Piper's clearly UK domiciled. Alex, it appears she's still domiciled in Canada. Now, she may in due course acquire a deemed domicile in the UK, which is where a person is treated for tax purposes as domiciled here by virtue of the length of time they've remained here. But assuming that's not relevant at the moment, we've got a split domicile. Now, when we're looking at the spouse exemption, what the rules say is that when you have a UK domiciled spouse leaving their estate or transferring an asset to a non-domiciled spouse, there is a cap on the spouse exemption, and that cap is equivalent to the current nil rate band. So this will apply if Piper were to die before Alex and her estate is passing to Alex. What it means is that Piper would have the nil rate band available to her estate. She would have an additional amount, which is the spouse exempt amount, up to another nil rate band level, but anything over that is going to bear an inheritance tax charge. And the rationale for that is that if a person is not domiciled in the UK, it's quite possible they may decide to relocate, in which case the assets they've inherited are taken out of the jurisdiction and out of the inheritance tax net. Now, if that were to happen and Alex is looking at an inheritance tax charge, she does have the option under the rules to elect to be treated as domiciled for tax purposes in order to access the full spouse exemption. But she's going to need some specific advice on this at the time, because by electing to be treated in that way, she is bringing in her worldwide assets into the inheritance tax net potentially. And that treatment's going to be applicable to her while she remains in the UK and for a time afterwards. So she will need to carefully balance up her options, and also she'll need to consider whether any double tax treaties may be an issue. Next slide. So there are a few other gifts around the edges of this that we need to cover off to make sure that we understand fully the tax exposure. And those are Alex covering the expenses, property costs, living costs, and also those gifts from the family that may be coming their way ahead of the civil partnership ceremony. So, gifts for Alex. Alex is covering the expenses. Now, a large proportion of these might be argued to be joint costs for which Alex is responsible for, and she's simply paying her way. But to the extent she's going above and beyond this, and she's making a stream of small gifts effectively to Piper, we need to understand if those cause any niggly tax problems that we need to factor in. Now, here, if it's cash gifts, which in the main it will be, we haven't got capital gains tax to worry about. Inheritance tax, we have two useful gift allowances effectively that we can utilise. One is the annual exempt amount for inheritance tax, which is £3,000. That can be rolled over for 1 year if unused in the previous year. So that might help. We can also make an unlimited number of lifetime gifts of up to £250 to different individuals. So that can also help. But neither of those sounds like it's going to be terribly relevant here if Alex has got this ongoing expenditure. But what might be really helpful is the allowance for gifts that are made out of excess income. Now, this is a very useful rule within the inheritance tax legislation that means that gifts are exempt from IHT if they form part of the donor's normal expenditure out of income, and that's their post-tax income, provided that after they have made the gifts, they have sufficient income to maintain their usual standard of living. So you need a regular pattern of gifting. You need to show that it's not putting Alex to any hardship. She's not having to dip into savings to fund this. And even the first of a series of gifts can qualify if it's evidence of an established intention.
Excellent. How would the gift be treated, Lucy, if the civil partnership was called off?
It's an important point, and it's a bit of a cliff edge difference in the tax treatment if it does and if it doesn't, really. When we're looking at the gifts from family, it's not going to necessarily be immediately a concern to Alex and Piper as the recipients, but it's going to be relevant for the people making the gift. And also, if they're making a gift that's a pet, the default rules for pets are that if on their death, that's the donor's death, there is any inheritance tax as a result of that pet, it's going to be the responsibility of either Alex and Piper, whoever receives the gift, to meet the tax payment, unless contrary intention is expressed in the donor's will. So what can the donors give that don't trigger these rules? Well, we've got the annual exemption amount. We've got gifts up to £250. Lifetime gifts are potentially covered if they're made in expectation of a marriage or civil partnership. There's a range of privileged relations who can make a gift of an amount to the marrying or civil partnering couple. They're relatively low. Broadly, a parent can give £5,000, a grandparent can give £2,500, either couple can give each other £2,500, and any one person can give £1,000. So one would expect the gifts to cover within this, but if they're making more significant ones, then yes, we've got pets to think about. If the ceremony is called off and we were relying on any of these exemptions to apply, then unfortunately they don't. So they are going to be pets. And, well, we might not have a gift situation at all if Alex and Piper need to give them back. So we've looked at the tax rules, but there are some important practical implications to be aware of that have a bearing on the tax rules. Those we've touched on earlier are the impact of beneficial joint ownership and whether an asset is going to pass by survivorship or not. Income on joint investments we've also touched on, and we'll come on to that a little bit further when we're looking at Alex's investment property. But critically, it is essential to have wills in place. If they don't have wills in place before marriage, they aren't going to inherit anything from each other. Cohabitants have no rights under the intestacy rules. They need to be aware of the potential impact of inheritance if something were to happen before they marry or before they enter into a civil partnership, because they have to plan for that inheritance tax charge if the intention is that one will receive the estate of the other. We have inheritance tax to factor in. They will need to think about what assets could be utilised to pay that. Where inheritance tax is due on the value of real property, you have the option of paying it in 10 equal annual instalments, but there is interest attached to that, so it's not always the most cost-effective arrangement overall. What they may consider doing is utilising trusts, making full use of their nil rate bands in their wills. And so, for example, in order to utilise the nil rate band fully, and in a way that doesn't put the value of that nil rate band as an asset into the survivor's estate, they might create a discretionary trust of that nil rate band that the survivor can benefit from. That achieves the result that they've put that into a flexible pot that's available to the survivor, but it's not aggregated with their estate. And ultimately, after the survivor's death, it'll be the trustees who decide where the value of that fund goes. So you need to anticipate the inheritance tax charge. If it's after their civil partnership and they are looking at a potential planning around if the spouse exemption is limited, again, they need to think about cash flow. So they might, for example, look at life assurance for the amount that will cover the tax. Because what we don't want is at a terrible time for both, well, for the survivor to have to find the money to pay the inheritance tax.
Lucy, what would be the particular considerations for their wills in this case?
Well, I think those touched on largely. It's particularly important to be aware of this aggregation rule when you're looking at what the survivor inherits. Obviously, anything the survivor inherits outright, it's going to be an asset of their estate, which means they can spend it, they can decide where it goes and how it passes under their will. If they die relatively soon after, you've got two bites at the inheritance tax charge in fairly quick succession. So we might have quick succession relief if they're within a small number of years. But one of the ways to avoid that is perhaps utilising the trust for as much as you can. If you're looking at giving a life interest to a surviving cohabitant, you have to be quite careful because a life interest, as you touched on earlier, is treated as an asset of their estate for inheritance tax. So again, you're doubling up on the tax charge. So let's quickly consider what the implications would be if Alex rents out the flat after she has given the joint interest to Piper. Rebecca has covered this quite extensively already, so it's simply a recap. And it's a recap along the lines of, well, they need to be clear on how that income is split and how the beneficial ownership is split. Now, in our case study, it's 50-50, which is quite helpful because it keeps things clear. And as touched on earlier, when a married couple or civil partners own a property together, they're deemed to own it 50-50 for income tax purposes. Now, that's regardless of the actual ownership. So if they want to split the income differently in different proportions between them, two things need to happen. They need to own it in those different proportions, and they also need to make the form election that Rebecca mentioned earlier to ensure that that is recognised by the revenue. Incidentally, that will also form the basis of the revenue's allocation of shares between them for capital gains tax purposes. They might also want to utilise post-civil partnership, the marriage allowance between them, which enables the higher earner to share part of their personal allowance with the lower earner, but that is subject to certain rules applying as well.
Lucy, are there any rules to be aware of if they hold this or any other investments actually through a structure such as a company or a trust?
Well, it'll depend on the type of structure they use. The corporate structure you went through very detailed earlier and the considerations there. They could also look at a trust structure. Something to be aware of though is the anti-avoidance rule that applies when a spouse that makes the gift into the structure is treated as effectively just shifting the right to income to them. So that's called the income shifting rules. Yeah. Now, outright gifts between spouses and civil partners are generally fine. They don't fall within those income shifting rules that occur in the settlements legislation. But when you do have a structure, you might need to consider this, because if the revenue looks at the arrangement and says, well, all you've effectively done here is move an income stream between spouses or civil partners, it may be subject to anti-avoidance rules.
Yeah.
Next slide. So finally, what happens if they split? Now, this is going to be touching on the implications of them parting ways as cohabiting partners, and then what would be the different tax treatment if they separated after their civil partnership ceremony. So the immediate tax difference and the impact on them pre and post civil partnership is the loss of the reliefs that would apply to them as spouses or civil partners. Here, the most significant taxes are going to be capital gains tax and inheritance tax, as a split usually involves the separation of assets between them and dividing up their estate and going their separate ways. So we touched on earlier in looking at the legislative rules that when we're looking at key dates for tax purposes, we've got a slight difference of emphasis between inheritance tax and capital gains tax. For inheritance tax purposes, the spouse exemption will apply provided they remain legally married or civil partnered. That applies up to the date of the decree absolute or the final order, the final dissolution order of the civil partnership. Where one spouse is non-UK domiciled, we've also got that to factor in. So transfers that take place prior to that date are covered by the favourable tax rules. Transfers afterwards revert to being pets. So if they are looking at moving assets between them in anticipation of this event, they're advised to do so whilst they are still legally civil partnered. For capital gains tax purposes, we do have an extra wrinkle to be aware of, and that is that whilst they are going to be connected parties in that the transfers between them will be deemed to take place at market value, the special rule that allows no gain, no loss between a spouse or civil partners is only going to apply for a limited period. it will apply in the tax year of their permanent separation. There are suggestions and clamourings in the community, in the legal community, for this to be extended to an additional year, so 2 years after separation, because if they are determined to separate in March of a year, they've got a very limited amount of time to take advantage of these rules. But that's an important feature to be aware of, and that's a key difference between assets shifting between them as cohabitants and as civil partners. If it's done as civil partners, this favourable rule that's the key differential is only available for a limited time. As a practical point, they'll need to update their wills. Wills are effective post a divorce or post a final dissolution order. However, they're treated as though any provision made for the ex-wife, ex-partner, or ex-husband, as though they died before the testator. So they are going to need to review those to make sure that they are they're as effective as they should be. Another important point in connection with a court order that's made on a dissolution or a divorce is that the general rule that treats gifts between partners as pets and events for inheritance tax may be sidestepped when you have a court order, because in those circumstances, if you are doing something, making a transfer pursuant to a court order, you're deemed to be doing that on non-gratuitous terms. It's effectively compliance with a legal obligation. So that may be relevant if you are looking at transfers of assets between you. And that would mean that effectively you haven't made a pet. That would mean there's no gratuitous element.
Lucy, what happens if one of them were to die after the divorce but before updating their will?
Well, it's important to remember that difference of the recognition of reference to a former spouse or civil partner in the will. It's critical that the will takes into account, when you're putting it in place initially, who would the default beneficiaries be if one of you were to die before the other. So hopefully you would have something to fall back on, but nevertheless, it would prompt you to review your will.
Yeah.
And what we often see is that when you are starting that divorce process or separation process, it's not always quick. And it may well be important to update your will before that happens, because of course it's going to be out of date pretty quick, even before the final order. So finally, when we are looking at the split of assets between them, the most contentious will be likely the family home, the most emotionally fraught as well. So we need to understand what the implications are so that they can plan for these, and what the difference would be separating as cohabitants and separating as spouses or civil partners. So the family home, because it's usually one of the most valuable assets that a couple will own between them, it has some favourable tax rules. Now, for capital gains tax, separating cohabitants, they're treated in the same way as transfers between cohabitants who are in a happy relationship. There is no difference if it is a transfer at the end of their relationship. There's no difference in the SDLT treatment, and there's no difference in the IHT treatment, provided it's not at arm's length. So we'd have to look at carefully at who's getting what on the separation and whether they are effectively buying each other out of interests. If they separate as spouses or civil partners, we do have some favourable rules. We've touched on the general position in terms of capital gains tax, inheritance tax, and the key dates. So for a married or civilly partnered couple, there's an extension of principal private residence relief when one of the partners is moving out of the family home and they transfer an interest, their interest, to the partner who remains in the home. Now, if there weren't special rules, if that moving out and transfer were to happen after the tax year of separation, it would be treated as a disposal for market value, with the capital gains tax implications that may bring. So what the rules say is that where relevant conditions are met, there is an extension of that application of PPR to effectively mean that you can still utilise that to exempt yourself from the gain you're deemed to make when you transfer, albeit that you have moved out of the property. There are some stringent conditions to satisfy. It's depending on the date of the transfer, the date on which they cease to use it as their main home to look at, but that is a softening of the rules that's available for civil partners and married couples that's not available for cohabiting couples. Lastly, SDLT. Not much of a difference. We still have SDLT to think about, save that a married couple, when they are transferring assets between them, if the transfer is made pursuant to a court order or an agreement that's been made in connection with that divorce or separation, it's not going to be an SDLTable transfer. It's effectively taking place in pursuance of executing a legal obligation as opposed to being a taxable event.
Lucy, for capital gains tax purposes, what does being separated rather than living together mean?
Well, it's a tricky concept because when you're looking at capital gains tax, how do you say that a couple have separated or not for these purposes? Is it determined by when somebody moves out? Is it when they have their final argument? It's quite tricky. So basically, a married couple or a sibling partner couple are treated as living together unless they're separated by a court order, by a deed of separation, or where one has moved out and the separation is likely to be permanent. Now, in each case, the relationship needs to have broken down. If the marriage hasn't broken down, but spouses or civil partners live in the same house or live in different houses at different times of the year, they're not going to fall within these rules. This is only when the relationship has come to an end. What constitutes permanent separation, as we said, is tricky. It needs proper consideration. But effectively, we need to look at the circumstances of the departure. We need to look at the situation in the round and present the evidence to HMRC in order to ensure that you've put a strong case forward prior to inquiries being raised, if they are raised.
Thank you. Next slide. So finally, that's just brought us to the end of our session. And I think as this final slide indicates, Lucy and I would agree that the best piece of advice we can possibly give to people from a tax perspective, certainly, is probably to get married. Quite often I have that conversation with their unmarried clients, and that's the starting point, particularly for inheritance tax. Aside from that, though, I think certainly my key takeaways from today would be that communication and clarity around both of these issues, you know, certainly with the case studies we've looked at today, are really important. Tax is crucial. We're both tax advisors, so I'm sure that, you know, that is important to us. But actually, asset protection is equally, if not more, important. And fundamentally, where you want your assets to go, should something happen to you, is really crucial. In practical terms, I think, as we've seen in both examples, making a will is really important. The prospect of dealing with somebody dying intestate is really complicated and actually quite emotionally challenging for those involved as well. So I think from a client perspective, my advice certainly would always be try to establish the priorities, try to establish what they're looking to achieve, and then devise a plan taking into account all the communication issues and the tax aspects that we've mentioned today. So that's it from us for today. Thank you very much for listening. There will be more detail on other sessions coming up shortly, but thank you very much. That's us done.